are several coverages that are simply mandatory. Automobile, workers' compensation, medical malpractice, the government steps in and insists that you must buy the coverage. So, and although we, as participants in the market, can point to competition there, that immediately affects the model, the paradigm of a perfectly competitive market with freedom of entry and exit of both buyers and sellers. Because if you mandate coverage, you can't have that. There's an interference in the marketplace. Government introduces the interference. And that opens the door to a couple other considerations, which are public acceptability and consumerism. And I'm getting close to the end of my what I'm going to say, but there's a tension there. And that tension is really the backdrop to all these rate filing best practices that we're going to talk about. So in Pennsylvania, when I came on board, there was a crisis. Filings had backed up. The administration had changed from a Republican administration to a Democratic administration. Companies were threatening to deem those filings. And the Casey administration, the new administration, decided to some extent to rely on competition in the competitive markets to regulate markets to the statutory standard. And among those thousands of filings were filings on nuclear liability insurance, on all kinds of financial insurance products that what value were we as regulators going to add in looking at rates and prices for exotic coverages that really there was no experience for. And we had to rely on competitive markets. And that turned out to work. And all parties were happy. There was more time for staff to deal with big picture issues. And we became more comfortable with the fact that competition encouraged innovation in the marketplace. So what is the conclusion that I came to? Well, competition works, but there's a tension with consumer interests. And that's really at the background of what we're going to discuss today when we discuss rate filing best practices and why we need to make these rate filings. So with that, I'd like to begin the meat of the session today by turning it over to Sarah, and I'm going to bring up her presentation.
Well, while Chet's doing that, I'll also have to start with an apology, and it's also weather related. We had a big snowstorm Monday morning, but we'd had one towards the end of the prior week, so planes weren't getting out, and my handouts are very nicely sitting in our office, so I apologize that they are not here. There are will be slides out on the website so that you can look at them. I really would much rather have you have them to have to throw them away, but that's what happens sometimes. Okay. So I'm going to start by telling you what is a good rate filing from an Alaska perspective. And I really want to sort of focus on the first here at the beginning, just what should be in that filing. And I'm going to talk about some of the things that are frequently missed. And so that's kind of the angle that I'm going to take here at the beginning. And we can either take paper filings or we do use SURF. And if you send us a paper filing, you know, the mechanics of it, we want two envelopes, three cover letters. We only need one set of the actual filing, the supporting documents, the rate manuals, and those kinds of things. What we do is our clerk gets it. She assigns it a state tracking number. And one of those envelopes and one of those cover letters goes back to you so that you know when we receive it, because then that starts the clock ticking. And then once it's reviewed by the analyst, if it's approvable or if there are questions, that second envelope is sent back to you with those questions. So that's the reason for getting those. If it's a SURF filing, of course, there's no envelopes and those kinds of things needed, but we do need to have all of the information in the SURF filled out. Specifically, some of the state-specific fields need to be completed, and one of them that I'll talk a little bit more about later is the filing method. We've recently, a year ago, had a statute change of how filings are made, and so that field is really very important to us. It helps us figure out where in the process it needs to go and how quickly we need to get to it. The other thing that's really important in SURF is if you are replacing a currently approved filing, please put in the Alaska division filing number of the filing that is being replaced. I know it says in SURF, if it's required, we do have a regulation that says you need to provide that to us. So please put that in. Again, that helps us just look at them quicker and go back and forth to see what changes are being made. We have three different types of filing methods depending upon the line of business and the size of the change. Flex rating, file and use, and prior approval, and a little bit later I'll tell you how to decipher which ones go where. If it's a revision or a replacement of an existing filing, again, we do need that prior state identification number. And another thing that is really critical is a marked copy showing the revisions. Again, that's required by regulation. And the regulation does say your marked copy should show your new material with an underline and your deleted material with a strike through. I know some of the new Word programs don't do that. They give you those little boxes over on the side. If there are a lot of changes, that's very difficult for us to decipher what's happening. If you want to use a different method than the underlining and strike through, you can, but you do need to talk to us about it first. The other thing I'll say about that, in the regulations that were passed related to the new statute change, the regulations were, I think, effective 3 or 4 months ago. There is a thing in there that says if you haven't provided the marked copy and told us what those changes are, we can consider them to be not approved. So this is really a very critical piece of information, and it does help us to do things much more quickly if we know what the changes are. If you're resubmitting a filing, if it's previously been withdrawn or disapproved, again, we do want to know what was the disapproved or withdrawn state filing number. Again, that helps us figure out what was questions so that we can be sure that all the questions were answered. And we do require that you put an effective date in your filing. And I'll talk about when I get to the specific filing methods some of the differences. But an effective date is required. If you don't know specifically when we're going to approve it so that you can give us an effective date, you can say something like 3 weeks after you approve it or something like that, but don't say on approval. We need something more specific. And as I say, these will all be, these statute and regulation sites will be on the slide so that you can get them there if you can't copy them down quickly enough here. Some specific types of filing, sort of getting over the mechanics of what makes a good filing. A loss cost adjustment filing, and I don't know why when we did our regulations this terminology was picked. This is really what we call more colloquially loss cost multiplier filing. We do need to have those reference filing adoption forms completed, and these are sort of the standard NAIC ones that I think everybody uses, but we do need to have those. They are available through a bulletin, which is available on our website if you don't have them. At the bottom, there is a section that talks about how to calculate the rate level change. We frequently see problems here, and sometimes I think it's because these forms may not be filled out by your technical people. We see sometimes people don't know the difference between a percent and a factor. We give examples, but it still doesn't always get through. So if you have somebody who is not a technical person filling these out, I would suggest that you take the opportunity to give them some training as to what's a factor. You know, if you're giving a 90% a 10% rate increase, we want to see a 1.1 in those little fields, not a 10%, that kind of thing. And also, if you're going to deviate from the rating organization loss cost filing, then please provide some support for that deviation, and please don't say it's just competition. We need to know your thinking, some statistical support, how your business differs from what you think is the business that's in that rating organization filing. Also, the other thing is that you do need to be referencing the rating organization filing that is effective on the date that you want your loss cost adjustment or your loss cost multiplier to be effective. Don't use an old one because we will write back to you and say, you've got to be using the new one. There are, as I said, three different types of filing methods. This statute is a little bit over a year old, probably maybe a year and 3 or 4 months. We still do retain prior approval for some lines of business. workers' compensation, medical malpractice, and assigned risk auto rate filings are still prior approval. Our prior approval is a 15-day waiting period with a 15-day extension. So that means once we get it in our office, and the way to count is the day that we receive it does not count as 15 days. It's the day after that starts the 15-day clock ticking. So we have 15 days to look at it. If we're busy or out of the office on things like this and don't get to it, then I can write to you and say I'm taking a 15-day extension. But after that, then if we don't do anything with it, it would be deemed approved. If we write you questions and say we need some more information or don't understand what's going on, then you have 30 days in which to respond to us. If you need some additional time, you can also request an additional 15-day extension, but you need to request that within the 30 days, the first 30 days of your response period. And if you don't respond, or if you send an incomplete response and don't answer all the questions that, or give us all the information, we can withdraw that filing. The second filing method is flex rating, and this applies to all lines of business except those that are prior approval, workers' comp, medical malpractice, and assigned risk filings. Your filing will qualify to be a flex rate filing if the cumulative rate change is within plus or minus 10% over the last 12 months. The effective date may not be earlier than the date that's received by the division. So if you send it to us and we get it today, you can start using it tomorrow. Unlike some other states that have adopted a flex rating, all of the regular statutory rate standards apply to flex rate filings. The inadequate and the excessive in Alaska and the unfairly discriminatory apply to flex rate filings. The filing does have to include some minimum information so that we can look at it and see that it really does meet those standards. We have to have an overall rate level calculation. You know, how did you get what you're proposing to do? We would like to see your expenses. And an exhibit that shows that it does meet the standards to be a flex rate filing. The statute does allow more changes more than once a year, but most companies, I haven't seen very many that have had multiple changes. Yes? I'll take questions at the end if that's all right. And then we also want to see the maximum minimum rate change. This is really to help us, not because we're going to disapprove it for those reasons, but because it helps us if we get consumer questions. If you have a 2% rate decrease, you might have some customers that are going to get a 10% increase. It just helps us be prepared when we get those questions rather than saying, oh, it was a 2% decrease, and then someone says, well, that's not what happened to me. So we do want that maximum and minimum rate change. And if you're in SURF, there's places to fill that in, so fill those out. If the basic information doesn't give us a comfort level that your filing meets the not inadequate, excessive, and unfairly discriminatory standards, we can write and request more information. If you can still be using that filing, we will just, you know, ask for that additional information. If after we've reviewed that and done whatever we need to do and we think that it does not comport with those standards, then we can disapprove the filing, but it's a formal process. It goes through the director, and we have to issue an order. The analyst reviewing the filing would not just write you a letter that says it's disapproved like it is on the other filing methods. And then there's the statutes and the regs that support what I've just said. The third filing method is file and use, and that's anything else that doesn't fall into the other two categories. The one thing also that I get a lot of questions about is what happens to rule filings. The statute says that all supplementary rating information is the file and use method, which is defined to include your rating manuals. So if you are making rule changes, this is a file and use process. Even if your overall rate change falls within the plus or minus 10%, if you are making rule changes, it needs to be a file and use filing. We do allow you to change your manual pages to correspond to the rate changes that you're doing on a flex rate filing without going through the file and use process. But if you are actually making rule changes, it cannot be a flex rate. Okay, then what needs to be in a filing? You know, pretty typical kinds of stuff. We don't really ask for anything unusual, but what we do need to see is your background and your support for the things that you do when you select your trend, your loss development, credibility, expenses, investment income. Describe what you're doing, how you're doing it, why you're doing it. And I know Alaska, you know, we're a very small state. We recognize that. We recognize that most of what is done is not credible or fully credible. But we still like to see the Alaska experience. So please give it to us. If you don't, we'll write and ask you for it. So say we recognize it's not credible, but if you have a couple of losses or what your premium volume is, we'd like to see that. And then just a couple of other things that we do frequently have to write questions on. We have some schedule rating plan regulations that we, as I say, frequently write questions when we get schedule rating plans. You need to include your eligibility criteria. You need a good description of what each risk characteristic is and not just, you know, classification peculiarities. Tell us something about it. Describe it a little bit so that, again, we can be comfortable that when those schedule rating plans are used, they're not done on an unfairly discriminatory basis. You need to include the range of debits or credits for each of those risk characteristics as well as an overall maximum debit or credit. And if there's a previously approved schedule rating plan, you need to specifically withdraw it when the new one is approved. And we also have a requirement that you acknowledge compliance with a couple of pieces of the regulation. And these would be things like you're going to uniformly apply your schedule rating plan to all eligible insureds. You're going to apply it at each policy renewal. You're going to apply debits and credits only for those risk characteristics that are in the plan. And that there's a worksheet that documents how you got to those debits and credits. And finally, just two other kinds of filings that we get questions about. Can we do Me Too filings in Alaska? Well, the answer is kind of yes and no. We do allow you to look at what other companies are doing, but you have to demonstrate that what they're doing is applicable to you. And we also like to know whether that other filing that you're copying is approved in Alaska, because it's really not very fair to tell the person who did all the work it's disapproved and then somebody else comes along and wants to use it, because that has happened. So please identify it if you're able to do that. And then A-rate filings, we do allow those, but again, under very specific circumstances, and we have an order that describes what those circumstances are. And if you do an A-rate filing, it can't just be a cover letter that says we're doing an A-rate filing. We do need to have a manual rule that will describe if you have any particular formulas or factors or guide A-rates that you're going to use, some kind of description of how you're going to develop those rates for that specific risk. And I think that's the last one. Yes, it is. So I don't know how you want to do this, Chet, if you want to take questions now or at the end, but I'm more than happy to answer questions. And if you have something specific also that you want to ask that's not appropriate to ask in a big room like this, I'm more than happy to talk to you individually as well.
Why don't we save questions?
Good morning. I have the handout. I'm not, my presentation doesn't quite gel with the slides, so I'm just going to keep that up there, and you could look at the handout. It'll be helpful, but we'll see how it sort of connects. For property casualty filings, the approval process depends greatly on the line of business and the type of filing. Both actuaries and examiners, and possibly others, play a part in the rate approval process. We receive filings by mail or through SURF. Our MARS unit checks that all the requirements on the department website have been addressed. If they have not been, the filings will be returned for modification. So it is very important that the items on the required forms are addressed adequately. After the filing has been accepted, it is sent to the supervisors of the various sections, which are based on lines of business. The commercial property section, which includes homeowners, the liability lines, automobile, which includes both private passenger and commercial. The casualty actuaries receive their own copies of all private passenger filings and all workers' compensation filings. So depending on the type of filing, you may have one or two people looking at the filing. The actuary's domain is anything that has a rate effect. Private passenger and workers' compensation are the lines of business with the largest premium volume. They are seen as the most politically sensitive. Automobile, because of the number and type of the average insured, who's the average guy whose power vis-a-vis an insurance company is negligible. And workers' compensation, because it is a state-mandated coverage, and the person that we are ultimately protecting is the worker, just the average guy with presumably little power. These lines have a history of prior approval. They are still prior approved, along with medical malpractice, which is also prior approval. Additionally, the filings that the actuaries are involved in are basically similar to one another. And the filings of a given insurer form a relative continuum over the years. The filings for the actuaries are the more important filings, and there are also fewer of them. For these reasons, if we can, we prefer to have the same actuary analyze the same company's filings over the years. The filings that are sent only to the examiners have a history of open rating. They are now flex rated. To a large part, the average policyholder is assumed to have a certain amount of business savvy, so the amount of oversight from the department is not as great. Also, many of the filings are small and include many different types, and often don't require that much time or communication with the company. For these filings, the actuary is brought in as a consultant. Although he can be brought into the process for any reason, his expertise is really needed when there is a rate effect aspect to the filing. I thought that the best way to approach this presentation was to go to the people who deal with the filings, ask them what they would recommend if they were asked, what the things that they find most problematic are, and whether any issues that a filer should be particularly sensitive to at this point. When they spoke about the filings, the examiners seemed to think of a puzzle which fit or did not fit into the rate filing sequence checklist. They also viewed the checklist as just one building block. The checklist was meant as a guide. It was their intention not to make it too specific because they didn't want to give the impression that they were directing the companies. They have recognized that to some extent, some of their problems have not been well addressed. They have other general forms that they have prepared to be used when needed. So this is a good time to mention that it seems reasonable to keep track of what is asked for during a rate approval process. And when you're called upon to do a similar filing, include those items at the start. I believe that that would be a real time saver. The actuaries look at the filing as an entity unto itself. Each aspect is examined along with its relationship to the other parts. The data is compared to other data, the market in general, the company's own financial data, as a check of its accuracy and reasonableness. The actuaries have been known to say that they never look at the rate filing sequence checklist. And that is probably unfortunate. Much of what we are interested in is specified in the checklist, even if it is in a somewhat regimented form. Also, if we had had more input, the checklist might have been a little bit more actuary friendly. I segmented the recommendations according to the percentage of filings to which the recommendation applies. All filings must follow the rules of the rate filing sequence checklist. All items in the checklist should be addressed. An NA should be put in all parts that do not apply. This way, a person handling the filing does not have to guess whether or not you overlooked the item. More importantly, many filers do not fill out the proper data in items where they do have data. My impression is that the latter problem is significant among consultants. If a filing contains a section that you think may be problematic, It should be filed separately if possible. The filings, when the analysis is completed, are entered into the rate approval program, which is a computer system program. This sends the recommendations of the analyst up the line to the head of the section, the bureau chief, or possibly to the executive staff. If the filing has not been completely addressed, it cannot be acted upon. If at this point in the filing process, we notice that only a part of the filing has been addressed, we have two choices. We can suggest to the company to withdraw its filing and refile as separate filings, or the company can wait until the analysis and the entire filing is completed and get the approval on all parts at the same time. We had a situation where a company asked for a Me Too on three programs within a line of business. Programs A and B could have been approved immediately. Program C had been approved for other companies, but there were aspects of it that the department and the companies did not agree on. We had to make a determination concerning new proposals while the disagreement still existed. The entire process took over a year. Every filing, no matter how it is submitted, should have a cover letter. The filing is a proxy for a company representative presenting its request in person. What it wants, why it wants it, and why it should get it. Some filings have hundreds of pages. The cover letter guides the analyst to the important information. It presents the arguments that support the request. It can bring in facts that support the proposal but aren't an integral part of the filing. It channels the reader's view of the proposal to be closer to the company's position. It is a win-win situation for the company. Also, the supervisor likes to have an idea as to what the filing says. There might be something significant which might require special consideration. A relatively short letter with such an item highlighted would be very helpful, especially since this is not the main work of the supervisor. The sooner the important points are known, the sooner they can be addressed, and the quicker the determination can be made. The department, incidentally, is changing its SURF requirement, specifying that a cover letter must be included with every filing. All SURF filings should be indexed. Some very large filings come in as one document. It makes it very difficult to find things, and so it is time-consuming. Before we had computers, we made paper filings. I don't think anyone considered presenting a paper filing without a cover letter, an executive summary, or a table of contents. These items evolved over time because they were useful. If they hadn't been, something else would have replaced them. It is not unreasonable that a proposal using new technology should try to include properties of the old system that were considered beneficial. Keep track of where your filing is. As I described before, filings go from the MARS unit to the individual sections where the analysis is done. The supervisor will get the actual filing if it is sent by mail, or the filing is put in his SURF mailbox if it comes through SURF. He is also informed by email of his new SURF filing. Sometimes this system does not work as well as it should. Therefore, if you send a paper filing, if you have not heard from the department at the end of some predetermined time frame, call and find out if there's a problem. If you have submitted a filing through SURF, keep checking who is assigned your filing. If the transition from supervisor to analyst seems to have stopped, that might be an indication that there is a problem. Again, you should contact the department. It is the department's position that filing on SURF saves time. It is our position that filings are handled in the order in which we receive them. However, we have noticed that the letters in the paper submissions are usually at least 2 weeks old when we get them, sometimes much older. A SURF filing is available sometimes as quickly as the day it is submitted. Therefore, all things being equal, the SURF system seems to give you at least a 2-week advantage time-wise. The department is working on instituting fail-safe procedures as regards confidentiality issues in SURF submissions. There have been concerns voiced by numerous companies in that regard. And any aspect of the filing that could be considered exceptional should be addressed. Much of the approval process relating what is being proposed to what has already been approved. If an approval
is not based on some unique characteristic of the filing company, approval for companies with similar proposals will be much simpler. Also, experience of companies are often similar in a given time period. If the experience of one company is substantially different, we are interested in knowing why. Now, for filings with the rate effect, which is approximately 60% of our submissions, we want to see the total rate effect as well as the rate effect by subline. Every filing must show the resulting greatest increase and decrease. If filing is made within 12 months of the last approval, the effect must consider both filings made during that period. A general complaint that mainly came from our actuaries was that often results of calculations were shown, or resulting choices were shown, without a description of the information, the calculations, or the judgment that produced them. The filing should be like a mathematical theorem insofar as every part that supports the request must be presented. The parts must be shown to be acceptable, and the way the parts come together to support the result must be shown as well. A very small subset of the population of rate filings is made up of ones we call innovative. They are the ones that, if approved, will change the market to some extent. For these filings, the original submission is only the beginning of the rate approval process. If the procedures are based on new technology, company representatives may have to come in to explain how the filing works. The effect on the insured population will have to be explained. How the filing improves the overall system should be highlighted. The data and the conclusions formed from the data will be given serious scrutiny. The filing will probably require input from the executive staff in order to gain approval. The executive staff, in New York representatives of the governor, will very often be sensitive to the different sections of the general population. The rate-making principle that a rating variable should be acceptable to the public looms large in this environment. It is for these filings that you have to be at your best, but it is with these filings that you are accomplishing the most. The more innovative the filing, the greater the effect on the market, the more scrutiny will be given to by the department, and the more time it is going to take. It is in your best interest that the people you are dealing with know and appreciate the proposal. When they speak to the members of the department, they are presenting the proposal just as you had proposed to them. Now, I discuss some important current issues. More complex private passenger automobile filings. We have seen over the past few years increased complexity in private passenger automobile filings. There are three basic reasons for this. Generalized linear models have become an accepted foundation for rate determination. The introduction of credit as an underwriting factor. In New York, it is only used for rating to improve an insured's rating position. And multi-tier systems have created sophistication. Many large companies have filed their own models. Smaller companies are filing models designed by others, possibly customized to their own needs. We are seeing models for different lines, different markets, and different subsets of lines. Additionally, the greater the number of companies availing themselves of these tools, the greater is the pressure on those companies that have not done so. The probability that those companies may become victims of anti-selection is heightened. There is also a snowball effect for that reason. If a plan is based on an algorithm, the algorithm must be disclosed. We want to see the criteria that make up the algorithm to see if they are acceptable. We want to see the coefficients of the variables as they will show the importance given to the variables. The company has to show statistical report for the formula itself and for the variables in the formula. There should be shown a test of the change, show data under the old system and with the new procedures applied. There can be a holdout sample where the algorithm is based on part of the data and the rest of the sample is used to test the new program. We are now asking for a disk with the algorithm on it so we can independently rate a person or a symbol or something else. These are the ways that we are turning what we once looked at as a black box into a submission acceptable for approval. The last thing is workers' compensation. I hadn't actually plan to talk about workers' compensation insurance. However, I believe that keeping abreast of changes in procedures or laws or rules within a state is part of best practices. As our governor has proposed changes to the workers' compensation system, I thought a discussion of the changes was reasonable. At present, New York is one of very few states with a rate service organization filing actual rates. Our statistical agent and rate service organization is the New York Compensation Insurance Rating Board. All commercial writers of workers' compensation are members of or subscribers to the NYC IRB. All commercial writers of workers' compensation, the amounts charged by all providers of workers' compensation protection, commercial insurers, self-insurers, and the state insurance fund, a competitive state fund, a state agency which is our insurer of last resort, are to some extent connected to the rates of the NYC IRB. We have not had a benefit change in workers' compensation since 1992. We have not had a change in the medical fee schedule or hospital agreement in 12 years. These contracts determine the cost that medical providers can charge for caring for workers' compensation claimants. The overall manual level is now almost 25% lower than in 1995. It is only 48% greater than it was in 1980, which is about 1.5% per year. We have approved for individual insurers rating plans and programs that deviate from the rates of the NYC IRB. Deviations downward only and on a company-wide basis, dividend plans, and large deductible programs. We have also approved the large risk rating option that the NYC IRB filed on behalf of its members and subscribers. LARO is a retrospectively rated policy for large insureds where the premium is determined by agreement between insurer and insured. The governor's proposal will increase the minimum weekly benefit from $40 to $100 and will gradually increase the maximum weekly benefit from $400 to $600 in 2009. From then on, these figures will be indexed to the average weekly wage. Permanent partial benefits will be limited as to the number of weeks that the benefits will be provided. The number of weeks in which the benefits are provided will increase with the degree of disability from 200 weeks to 500 weeks. A draft was introduced to both the Senate and the Assembly on March 3rd and was passed by both houses yesterday. The parts of the bill that directly involve the insurance industry are the following. The Superintendent of Insurance is to report to the governor and the legislature before September 1st, 2007 on matters relating to the Compensation Insurance Rating Board. It specifies that the report address the manner in which the Compensation Insurance Rating Board has performed those tasks delegated to it by statute or regulation, whether any of those tasks would more appropriately be performed by any other entity, including a government agency, and the rate-making process for workers' compensation. The other pertinent sections are, there's an addition to section 2313, notwithstanding any other provision of the article, no rate service organization may file rates, rating plans, or other statistical information for workers' compensation insurance after February 1st, 2008. Notwithstanding subsection J of this section, such rate service organization shall nonetheless be required to be licensed pursuant to this section. Section 2316 is also being amended. I think you will find it interesting. I know that I do. It is short, so I will read both the before and after versions. The before version is, no insurer or rate service organization shall agree with any other insurer or rate service organization to change or adhere to any rate, although insurers and rate service organizations may continue to exchange statistical information. The after version is, no insurer or rate service organization shall agree with any other insurer or rate organization to charge or adhere to any rate, although insurers and rate service organizations, other than rate service organizations with respect to workers' compensation, may continue to exchange statistical information. Everything that I have said here comes from the legislation or from articles available to the public. I must note that the legislation that I was referring to was the legislation that was submitted to the legislature. The legislation that passed may be different. There are many scenarios into which this information might fit. However, forewarned is forearmed, and that is best practices as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I open it up to questions, I'd just like to swing back around and put kind of a conclusion to this. I opened up by pointing out that basically for most lines of business, we're dealing with competitive markets. And in several cases, the markets are not perfectly competitive because the government has already interfered in the market by mandating coverage. But in competitive markets, to compete, you have to change your prices frequently and efficiently. And the importance of filing of best practices is, as a firm or a consultant to a firm, you need to make that process efficient. And it behooves you to understand, since this is a regulated industry, what the regulator is expecting so that you minimize the number of go-arounds on each filing. So you need to pay attention to these items in particular, and you need to develop an efficient methodology of presenting your filing. For example, I remember in Pennsylvania, if I would triage all these filings that came to me, and triage meant, for example, facially, a filing may be so facially evident as meeting the requirement that as it came across my desk, it didn't get assigned to an actuary for further review. It was simply approved. But to do that meant that that filing on the face of it essentially had a very succinct executive abstract that said, this filing does this, the rate effect is this, the range is this, the intent is this. And that I could feel comfortable with all of those items and triage that filing and rely on the marketplace to regulate it. And so as we delve into the questions, I'd like you to keep in mind that the purpose of this session is for you to gather what really is important to the regulator to make that process more efficient for you so that you can compete in the marketplace. And now I'd like to turn it over for questions. I think to summarize the question before I turn it over, you, in the context of the maximum and minimum effect of the filing, how does that pertain to service contract business, where most of the business is not renewal, but it's new business? And so therefore, in that context, how is the regulator considering the range?
I haven't seen one of those, so I can't speak from experience, but I'll try to tell you how I would look at it. I think what I would do is, knowing that that's what happens in that kind of business, if you would explain to me that says this is inappropriate because we don't have renewal business, I would understand that that's the reason that it does not make sense.
When we when we get the greatest and smallest rate change, we ask who it affects. If it doesn't affect anybody, then we look at it differently.
And I will tell you that in Pennsylvania, extended warranties are not even regulated. Mr. Butler.
My experience with rate filings and everything is about
To summarize the question, Mr. Butler is asking, is pointing out that historically in Pennsylvania in particular, that the filing process and rate filings were available for public scrutiny, and that in addition to he noticed that there were competitors in there reviewing those filings, and he's asking if that process exists, particularly in the age of electronic filings. So I'm going to turn it over to the other panelists, and I'll come back around to it.
Alaska statutes say that rate filings are public after they become effective. So, yes, and we get lots of requests for rate filings. The way we handle them, I mean, if you're in the vicinity and want to come and review them, you can certainly come into our office and do that. But mostly what we do is we have a public records request form on our website, identify what it is you're looking for, we find the information and send it to you and bill you for it.
In New York, you have to fill out a FOIL request. The FOIL request is on our website, and they give you all the instructions about what what you have to do. What you can't do is say, I want to see all, private passenger rate filings done by company, maybe by company X, but you couldn't see, all of a certain kind of rate file, all dividend plans, that kind of thing. We're not gonna do that. You have to be very specific, but it's very easy.
Okay, this is Chet, and I'm going to speak from two perspectives, and I think a lot of people in the room are probably going to have some sense of both of these perspectives, and maybe even better than me. But first of all, from a regulatory perspective, yes, those filings are still available. However, everybody's moving to become less and less paper bogged down and more paper free. And even when I was still at the department a couple years ago, that process is not a favorite function of the staff. So it is kind of a bit of an orphan. In other words, having a library of these filings. So what you see is what you get, and it's not always complete. There are, and I'm going to move into I'm transitioning now as I transition from the department. While I was at the department, and I think a lot of people in the room probably know this, that there are firms that specifically go into the insurance department, the bowels of the department, review those filings, and produce newsletters that summarize the kind of rating activity that has gone in, and then make available for purchase copies of those filings or analyses of filings. And that's kind of a cottage industry that's out there and that exists. And in my current job, I see across my desk frequently these little flyers about filings, and different people within my organization will raise the question, do we need to get this one? Should we look at that one? Now, I'm going to share one other thing, though, Pat, for your benefit, which is if we look at the personal lines, and this probably applies to commercial lines also, that has become so darn, I was going to use a more colorful word, but so darn competitive that I suspect that what you see in the filing doesn't really tell you and how those rates are set, because frankly, the credit scoring models are so sophisticated, and there's this tenuous link between underwriting and rating that you have to be careful how you interpret what you see in rate filings. And I think that's a fair statement, and I don't want to say too much more about that. But the marketplace is the complexity because of all of these tools and generalized linear modeling and predictive modeling and the availability of credit information and this tenuous relationship between underwriting and rating. You have to be careful how you interpret what you see in those rate filings. More questions? Jim Rowland, who was the past chair of the casualty rate making seminar when it was last held in New Orleans, has asked the question, what does the panel, what's the panel's opinion of the repeal of McCarran-Ferguson? Thank you, Jim.
That's an interesting question and something that I have mulled over and don't really have a good answer for, because McCarran-Ferguson is really sort of the basis of why we have rate filings and rate regulation. So what those changes are, I don't have a, you know, I can't predict very well, but I would see that there would be some changes. I mean, just because it's the basis for what we do, how it's going to happen would depend on exactly how it's repealed, if anything replaces it. But yeah, it could affect things quite a bit.
I agree with that, and but I you know, a lot of the things that we have, such as the collection of data that many of us share, are done because, you know, that they're really needed. And so with any framework, it would seem that the things that the companies need in order to get their job done would have to be provided on some basis.
This is a really interesting question, and I have to go back to, and I enjoy this question because my background is economics, and you have to go back, I think, to economics to really get into answering this question. And I think, and I'm not, what I'm about to say is not Chet as a member of the Donegal Insurance Group, or Chet as a member of the Casualty Actuarial Society, or Chet as a former regulator. This is Chet, who really enjoyed economics. And that Chet thinks that regulation grew up because of the government interference in the marketplace to begin with. And I'm using the word interference with a little I. I mean, if you look historically, but there is a reason why government interfered in the marketplace, but government did. And the fact is, although you have competitive forces there, the government came along and mandated that there be certain coverages, which kind of was a catalyst for even more consumerism in those particular markets. At the same time, a lot of this started before we had computers and the ability to assimilate information and more sophisticated modeling techniques, and there was a tremendous need to share information. But I think regulation, and particularly stringent regulation that kind of impeded the ability to respond in the marketplace, I think if in anything encouraged more companies in the marketplace, more insurance companies in the marketplace, and perhaps an inefficiency in the marketplace. And I would suspect that if McCarran-Ferguson is repealed, that in the long run, I'm guessing you're going to see an even greater struggle for survival of the fittest in the marketplace, that you're going to see a lot of falling out of smaller, less efficient players, and perhaps even a couple big inefficient players in the marketplace. Because rates will, to the extent that you get real deregulation in the price arena as a result of the repeal of McCarran-Ferguson and or more uniform regulation, I think that you're going to see a tremendous burgeoning of pricing activity that is going to winnow out the weaker performers in the marketplace. And you're going to see an increased pressure on these new innovative tools because there's going to be less of an ability to share information. I think that's what's going to happen. So, any other questions? Pat?
Anomaly is this, is my understanding, and
Well, I'm going to go ahead. Are you finished? Well, I think you're I'm going to paraphrase to be a bit succinct, and I don't want this to turn into the Pennsylvania, but I'm going to answer your question because, and I was very involved in that process, and it happened while I was still at the department. Okay, first of all, Pat Butler is asking whether specifically about the impact of Act 6 and a particular feature of Act 6 in Pennsylvania, which was an auto insurance reform package that was implemented in 1990 that really has been very, very successful. It introduced tort election, where insureds could opt for limited tort or full tort coverage. And well, I'm going to take considerable issue with the representation that you made because it's completely wrong. In fact, what economics would suggest, which is that people with lower incomes who have less property to protect and less incomes are going to see several effects that are going to suggest that they would more likely opt for the limited tort coverage. And in fact, that is the case. They universally opt more frequently for limited tort coverage. And those are the low income, particular territories, especially Philadelphia, and younger drivers all disproportionately opt for limited tort. Also, curiously enough, there is another group of people who opt for limited tort who are people who credit score gets after, who self-select that they use the system differentially, that they use the system as more of a kind of coverage for catastrophic events as opposed to more routine events in litigation. Now, the Temple study didn't argue or didn't make the point that limited tort electors were disproportionately higher income or anything like that. It made the point, based on its analysis, it was attempting to make the point that there was an inappropriate price differential, or the price differential wasn't appropriate because the price differential didn't adequately account for the better experience that the limited tort electors were generating. And as a result of that, there was a study done that resulted in those differentials being adjusted by coverage and increased pretty dramatically from what they had originally been when the law was implemented. Now, whether they are appropriate now, I'm not going to comment on, and there are issues underlying this about the availability of data in individual filings and the availability of data in ISO and all those things, which I really can't comment on. But the one point is the economics holds true that people with less incomes and less wealth to protect generally do opt for the limited tort coverage.
Take it than that. 15.3% discount went across everything. It went across physical damage. It went across everything. It's now been taken away from physical damage. There's no, and you, this is for you to correct me on if I'm misrepresenting it, as you say, that it's not applied to physical damage at all. It's only uninsured motorist liability coverage and whatever else, uninsured motorist liability coverage and PIP, or whatever it is in Pennsylvania that those things cover now. Is that correct?
Yes. But the aggregate amount of the aggregate effect of that is much greater in Philadelphia than the 15.3.
Sure.
Right. Okay. And the 15.3 across the board in 1990 was just an attempt to make this more efficient in the transition because there was considerable uncertainty about what the real effect of the law would be. But I think I'd be happy to discuss this with you outside of the room, but we shouldn't be. Okay. All right. More questions?
Could you comment on what you consider to be the best practices surrounding the filing that is heavily influenced by GLMs? What do you need to see in a company's approach for a GLM in order to say it's appropriate?
Summarize, what are best practices when submitting a filing that relies on generalized linear modeling analysis? So I'll turn it over to the panel.
Good question, because it is more difficult to get data and to be comfortable with what's going on. What we've asked companies to do is try to describe the process that they go through in developing their model, give us their assumptions. If you've got equations that are easily demonstrable, provide those, and I know that's the hard part. What's the result of it? How did you decide that your results are applicable? I mean, a lot of it is probably more narrative than some of the standard kinds of things that you see, but anything that can give us a comfort level on what you're doing is appropriate technically as well as appropriate for your book of business.
Well, I think the things that I said about when I was talking about the more complex private pastoral reveal filings apply here. That, you know, you sort of have to describe the algorithm, you have to say what the criteria are, you have to talk about the coefficients so we can see how the thing, you know, blends together. As the filing gets more and more complex, the way that the department kind of relates to the filing becomes more personal. And so we have, for these models, we have two actuaries that work at least as consultants with the other actuaries. And you probably get involved talking to them. And what happens is they ask, you know, as it strikes them, and depending on the history that they've had with other filings, they ask certain questions and you kind of have to respond. There's a certain comfort level that they want. And all the things that we've done are ways of making this sort of, this is also considered a black box, making it such that we can approve it.
Anything else? Well, thank you very much. Would you join with me in giving some recognition to our panelists? Thank you.